Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome back to Well That Aged Well. This week, we are joined by Richie Robertson, who have written recently about the Enlightenment, which we are going to cover in two parts, because it's quite a big topic and quite a big book, so we don't have time to cover it all in one go. And I also asked about this to get to know the guest better. So what was it about the Enlightenment that brought you so intrigued to write this book that I'm showing right here?
That's a very difficult question, because my interest in the Enlightenment and my attraction to Enlightenment authors goes back many, many decades, since I read Hume and Gibbon as a young man. Well, the immediate prompt was an invitation from a publisher at Penguin to write a book on the Enlightenment, something which I would never have thought of for myself. I've written over the years many reviews and articles for the Times literary supplement, and that gave me practice in addressing a wider non-academic audience, something which I'm very keen to do, and that obviously attracted this publisher's attention. I felt the writing about the Enlightenment on this scale was at the very limits of my powers, but anyway, I sat down and in the course of 5 years produced the book you see, with, I must say, very great enjoyment. I felt as though there were a book about the Enlightenment inside me, waiting to come out. And it takes a publisher of genius to spot such a potential book.
So I want to begin. I want to begin with, what was the Enlightenment exactly?
Well, that, of course, is a very big question, which it took a 900-page book to answer. But much more briefly, I think I'll say three things. First of all, and most conventionally, we think of the Enlightenment as an intellectual movement. And if we're unsympathetic, a movement of dead white men in wigs, well, it was an intellectual movement, but much more than that. And I begin the book not with a dose of philosophy, which is how books of the Enlightenment usually start, but with some attempt to say what difference Enlightenment made to ordinary people. Because the second meaning I attach to Enlightenment is a change of outlook, a change of sensibility, if you like, a change of mentality, which Max Weber summed up as the disenchantment of the world. So I want to say that there was the Enlightenment of the intellectuals, but the much more pervasive Enlightenment below the popular level. And thirdly, I give a chapter in the book to practical enlightenment. I mean by that the attempts by governments, especially on the continent, to introduce rational or at least well thought out policies in government, in the organization of society, in the administration of justice, and thinking of penal reform, for example, in education, in care for the sick. And We'll come on to these topics later, perhaps in the second part. But I just say that while these measures in Britain were largely left to free enterprise, on the continent, they're much more a concern of government. And I think it's a good effect. So you have the intellectual enlightenment. You have popular enlightenment spreading, as it were, invisibly. And third, you have the reform efforts of enlightened monarchs and administrators.
And we will cover the enlightened monarchs in the next part, of course. And
yeah,
I want to begin before we go into, as you do in the book, but I want to begin with the world before the enlightened. And what was the world like right before the enlightened philosophers and the enlightened people began to realize all the things we are going to talk about today? So I want to begin to talk about a little bit how different was the world before entering the moment before entering the Enlightenment.
The major keynote of the world before and even during the Enlightenment was fear. There was a great deal to be afraid of, and the Enlightenment was in part an attempt to free people from unnecessary fears. I've given my book the subtitle The Pursuit of Happiness, but the reduction of fear, although less catchy, would also have served. Well, there was a very great deal to be afraid of, and some of it philosophy couldn't do much about. For example, healthcare. It's been argued that until the beginning of the 20th century, medical science killed more people than it cured. Satire on doctors is pervasive throughout the period. There are many diseases which required difficult and painful operations. For example, people with a bad diet often suffered from gallstones and kidney stones and blockages in the urinary tract. These are extremely painful, agonizing. But operations to get rid of them were so bad that people often preferred to suffer. Samuel Pepys, for example, in the 1650s, was operated on for the stone, and the operation, his recovery, was a major epoch in his life. At the other end, in 1811, Francis Burney, the novelist, had an operation for cancer. There was no anaesthetic in those days. The invention of chloroform in the mid-19th century was a major turning point in medical history, and so she was sedated with laudanum, a very mild form of opium, and doctors set to work to cut out the cancer, which took from her breast, which took 20 minutes of unremitting agony. Hmm. And she describes in a letter to her sister how she screamed throughout that time. The operation worked, but of course they very often didn't. So illness was a pervasive problem. And then some scourges were beginning to disappear. Famine, for example, still occurred. There were some very serious famines in the 18th century. In northern Italy, for example, in the 1770s, although the greatest famine of the period was the artificially induced famine in Bengal in India due to the mismanagement of the East India Company. But in Europe itself, famine was becoming rare. War was still frequent. It's been estimated that there were only 3 years in the 18th century in which there wasn't a war in Europe. And of course, the end of the period, the Napoleonic Wars, provided for 25 years of almost incessant warfare. Mm. So all these were things which one was rightly afraid of. But there are also unnecessary fears, superstition. People were afraid, for example, of seeing the moon, the new moon, through glass, of seeing a black cat cross the road in front of you, and many other
I mean, I'm
things.
still afraid of that, so,
Well, the Enlightenment has some work to do, and more seriously, religion fostered fear. It'd be a great mistake to think that Enlightenment was simply against religion. By and large, Enlightenment thinkers wanted a sensible and rational religion, but preachers relied very much on fear in order to keep their flock in line. And it was thought that unless some people were afraid of hell, you'd commit all sorts of crimes.
I
So we
mean, I
have.
want to mention, when you mentioned fear of religion, sorry for
Yeah,
interrupting you there,
go on.
but I want to mention the book that you write a little bit about the work of fiction you are set in the future that I found interesting, where the Pope is more of a figurehead and religion kind of disappeared. And I don't remember who wrote it, but it's kind of a utopia where the Pope is more of a figurehead. And it kind of is what the Pope is today, that book write about. I feel like how that. I'm sure you remember the book I'm talking about, but
I do.
it was interesting, that book. I remember when you talked about the fear of religion, and I wanted to bring this up as well, because this book kind of shows a future of religion, and it kind of shows our future today, I think, what it's our future became. And of course, there's even religion in the light, but it's an interesting work of, and it was written in the 18th century as well.
Yes. That's the novel entitled The Year 2400. It's not a straight work of utopian fiction. It is partly a satire, but it certainly imagines that the Pope, for example, will have been transformed into a teacher of morality, and that formal religion will have died away. But anyway, in the real 18th century, that wasn't the case. And what Enlightenment thinkers wanted to do was take the unnecessary fear out of religion and substitute an emphasis on morals. There was, for example, a particular branch of the Enlightenment within the Catholic Church. There were even two enlightened popes. And the aim of the Catholic Enlightenment, a movement that historians have become aware of really only in recent decades, was to do away with or to minimize pilgrimages, processions, blessings, rituals, and what have you, and to preach morality, and also to direct the attention of the clergy towards pastoral care. The Catholic Enlightenment flourished in Italy, Austria, and South Germany, and his great proponent was a major Enlightenment thinker whom we shouldn't forget about, Ludovico Antonio Muratori. So all along the line, you have attempts to make religion a more rational pursuit, more compatible with good sense.
And I want to begin, of course, a little bit, not let me begin, but it's talking a little bit about the world before the Enlightenment. And what do you begin with? And I want to sort of begin opening up the Enlightenment world as well, is the idea of pursuit of happiness, because as you mentioned, the idea of happiness in those days is quite obviously quite different from what we think of as the pursuit of happiness. We think of it as travel. We think of it as having money, going to the pub with our friends on Saturday, Friday night, or maybe watch a movie or read a book, whatever, unfinished work at 8 or 5 p.m. and then go home and, to family. But so let's talk about the idea of pursuit of happiness back in those days and how the philosophers came up with the whole idea of what is the, and that's the title of this episode, of course, this pursuit of happiness. But so let's talk about the idea of what that began with the pursuit of happiness.
Well, you just been talking about pleasure, about hedonism, and the ideal happiness includes that, but much more. Enlightened thinkers found it possible to imagine that God intended us to be happy, not to have our happiness postponed until the next world, which is getting harder and harder to believe in, but to enjoy some happiness here on earth. Now, pleasure is fine, and you can find plenty of enlighteners who speak up for pleasure. Voltaire, for example, has a rather nice poem called Le Monde, The Man of the World, who celebrates some drinking champagne. But Enlightenment thinkers were serious, and they realized, as Samuel Johnson put it, that life offers little to be enjoyed and much to be endured. So they often said that the best you can hope for is a modest happiness, avoiding serious evils, and keeping a calm and equable temperament. In other words, they set the bar for happiness rather low, but it's still an ideal. That, however, applies to the happiness of individuals. In the Enlightenment, there was also the ideal of public happiness. Governments and rulers came to think that they ought to provide actively for the happiness of the people. That is, not only to not only to ensure j justice, but also to work actively for people's well-being. And that was particularly the aim of the various enlightened monarchs, whom we'll no doubt talk about in the second part. So, private happiness, enlighteners were fairly realistic about the possibilities for leading a happy life. Public happiness, the duty of monarchs to ensure the well-being of their subjects. These are the keynotes of the Enlightenment.
So what's the happiness for the common person, like in general in those days, and then like what would be something thought of as happiness for them?
Well, I think I've really an answered that question. But the ideal was not, on the whole, in intense pleasure, too much to hope for, but tranquility and the good fortune to be free from illness and other disturbances. So there's a lot of luck involved.
It was a much simpler time than what we think of as happiness today. But another thing that you write, next thing you write about, of course, is the end. I want to talk a little bit about superstition as well, because we talked about some superstition that people were very superstitious about, like Mad Cat earlier. But as you well know as well, comets were, of course, about science as well. So you mentioned that in the Enlightenment, they start to kind of mock these signs that, super, I mean, you talked a little, like you said, you talked a little bit about this earlier, but, I want to talk a little bit about how the philosophers begin to think about, oh, maybe a comet is just a comet flying by. It doesn't mean that, oh, we wear the eyes of Marshall, like Caesar saw a comet and he died on it. It's something that's going to happen, but, or, let's say, whenever someone sees a comet, they think something bad is going to happen, or like you said, a black cat. watching across the world. So let's talk a little bit about how they began mocking the idea that superstition might not be a thing.
Well, they didn't only dismiss superstition on that kind of trivial level. Let's take a step backwards. Before the Enlightenment, was widely felt that the world was full of signs and symbols planted by God. The Christian should observe the world around him for indications of God's favor or disfavor. And in spiritual autobiographies of the 17th and sometimes the 18th century, you can find people observing what seem to us trivial and casual events and interpreting them as either blessings or warnings from God. Now, this is the outlook that Weber talked about as the enchanted world, and its fading was the disenchantment of the world. To take one concrete example, in 1680, a lot of people were very agitated by by a highly conspicuous comet, and inferred all sorts of disasters from it. One of the major thinkers of the Enlightenment, Pierre Bayle, wrote a book entitled Thoughts on the Comet, in which he argued that although comets were commonly seen as heralds of some kind of disaster, they were really just natural events. A comet was simply a comet. The world came gradually to be seen as full of phenomena which were simply themselves not messages in a script written by God. Thus, the world became disenchanted. And, well, may have become free from magic, and to that extent more boring. It was also much more free from fear. And not only that, but the decline of superstition, the decline of the enchanted worldview, enormously assisted the growth of science, of natural science. And that was the major Enlightenment preoccupation. One of the founding events of the Enlightenment was the establishment in 1661 of the Royal Society in London, of thinkers dedicated to simply finding out about the natural world. And presently, academies of science were founded in other countries, usually supported by the state. The London Royal Society was financed by its members with the aid of a grant from Charles II, but it largely depending on its members' donation. So science became very conspicuous. The scientific revolution of the 17th century, which we associate with Galileo, Boyle, Harvey, and Newton, was
I mean,
carried
this
on.
just that one in the end of this episode, of course.
Yes, was carried on in the 18th century. I mentioned Newton. Newton's Principia Mathematica was published in 1687, and I began my book in the 1680s because it was the decade of Bayle, who I mentioned earlier, a very influential thinker, and above all, the decade of Newton, whose Principia, putting forward the theory of gravity, revolutionized people's understanding of the natural world. The world came to be seen as following laws which could be expressed in mathematical terms, as predictable, and to a large extent, therefore, as manageable. Now, there was no contradiction felt between the Newtonian or scientific understanding of the world and the presence of God. But it did mean that traces of God's activity were not to be looked for all the time in the world. God was remote. He had set the world going according to his immutable laws, and then retreated and left the world largely to run by itself. I say largely because Newton's calculations required God to intervene from time to time in order to rebalance the system of nature. But on the whole, the day-to-day world could do without God. And if you go one step further, you arrive at deism, a common belief among enlighteners, Voltaire, for example, the belief that God created the universe but no longer intervenes in it, but leaves it to run by itself.
Mm.
And that has many consequences.
And that was a mistake.
Well, there's some people who have different opinions. It was problematic because it was actually quite hard to reconcile with the Bible. Mm. What do you do with the belief that Christ was a manifestation of God on earth? Because the God of deism, the definition, stays away from the world. So, logically, you have to understand Christ not as the Son of God, but as a good man. And then, what happens to miracles? The miracles reported in both the Old and the New Testaments become incredible, because nature is understood as orderly, and a miracle, an interruption of the order of nature, really has no place in this scheme. One answer to this question was provided by David Hume, who is, on the word, the outside left of the Enlightenment. His notorious essay on miracles argues that miracles are always reported. Now, a report of an event becomes harder to believe the further back the event is. Miracles that took place 1,500 or 2,000 years ago are always dubious. They depend on eyewitnesses who can't now be interrogated. And so it's always more likely that reports are mistaken than that an interruption of the order of nature really took place. That, I think, is logical and unassailable, but for the time, it was a very extreme statement of skepticism. Anyway, the problem now was to reconcile the orderly universe revealed by modern science with the Bible, and as opposed to the Bible or the Word of God. But perhaps I ought to pause there for a moment.
Pardon?
Perhaps I ought to pause there, or shall I go on?
No, please go on, yeah.
Okay. In the background of the Enlightenment, you have to imagine not only the advances made by modern science and the understanding of the world, but also, absolutely crucially, the Protestant Reformation. The division of the church into churches did a great deal to discredit Christianity, because which version of Christianity were you supposed to accept? And a very important division was over communion, the Eucharist, the real presence. The Catholic belief was that Christ was literally present in the bread and wine taken in the Eucharist. How this was possible was a mystery which nobody could explain. And we do have some records of popular scepticism. How can Christ's body be in so many places at once, for example? Some wag is recorded as getting into trouble for asking, if you eat Christ, why don't the bones crack in your teeth? But more seriously, if you no longer believe that the Mass celebrates the real presence, the actual presence of Christ in the Eucharist, if you believe, the Protestants do, that his presence is simply symbolic, then that is a major step, perhaps the biggest step, towards the disenchantment of the world. Whereas for the medieval church, magic happened every time the Mass was celebrated. Now, the Eucharist becomes simply a symbolic ceremony. It commemorates Christ's sacrifice, but it doesn't reenact it. So that helps to open the way for the disenchanted, rationally intelligible universe of the Enlightenment. And that's simply one way in which the Reformation changed the world. Another lay the understanding of the Bible. For Protestants, the text of the Bible was all important. Salvation, as Luther said, was sola fide et sola scriptura, by faith alone and by the scripture alone. The Catholic Church, on the other hand, laid great emphasis on tradition, on the way in which the truths of Christianity had been handed down through many generations, going back to Christ and his disciples. The Protestant Reformation meant the people came to read the Bible, not just the small excerpts presented to the faithful by the Catholic Church, but by the whole text, which is very large and full of contradictions. And it also meant that people began historical inquiries. Where did the text of the Bible come from? Who wrote it? Who copied it out? Where can the earliest manuscripts be found? Erasmus, at the beginning of the 18th century, not a Protestant, and somebody who tried to hold the line between warring factions, made an edition of the Greek New Testament, going back to the earliest available manuscripts, and he found, as did other textual scholars, that many doctrines thought to be important, even essential to Christianity, were simply not there in the text of the New Testament. For example, the idea of the Trinity, the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, is simply not there in the New Testament, except in one very disputed text, not found in the earliest manuscripts, which says, these three are one. Or?
Yeah, if I may, it almost sounds like Arianism in a way from the medieval Constantine's time.
Well, Arianism was very thoroughly suppressed, but what do you call a modern form of Arianism, that is Unitarianism, belief in a single God instead of the Trinity, had some distinguished supporters in the Enlightenment in the 17th and 18th centuries, but you'd be very unwise to admit to your Unitarianism. Milton was a Unitarian, didn't believe in the Trinity. John Locke, likewise. The Quakers are essentially Unitarians, and they were duly persecuted. Fortunately, they had an influential member, William Penn, who obtained a royal grant to found a colony in Pennsylvania where religious freedom was allowed. But if you admitted your Unitarianism, you could be sure of trouble. Newton was a Unitarian, but kept it to himself. His successor in the chair of mathematics at Cambridge, William Whiston, was not so cautious, and he was dismissed from his chair. Anyway, it was discovered by those who prepared to attend the doctrine of the Trinity does not have biblical authority, and there are many other dogmas that don't survive scrutiny. A famous example, the virgin birth. One problem is that Jesus had brothers, so Mary can't have remained a virgin. Another is that the doctrine of the virgin birth is based on a prophecy in Isaiah, where the original word simply means a young woman, not virgin, has been wrongly translated into Greek. Christianity, therefore, became clear, acquired a number of accretions which could not be justified in the text of Scripture. Now, these insights were very difficult to accept, not only because of the authority of the churches, but also because it's very difficult to part from beliefs you've been brought up with. You have to think of the emotional difficulty of rejecting beliefs that seemed essential to Christianity. You have to think also, when it comes to reducing superstition, that pilgrimages to the shrines of saints, to holy wells and whatnot, processions and church festivals and so forth, were actually very dear to people. And they were losing something, losing a value distraction in their lives, if they were encouraged by enlightened clerics to pursue a more rational, more ethically based version of Christianity. And then, of course, religion became taken up by politics, and hence you have the religious wars between Protestant and Catholic princes, which were severe enough in the 17th century, and in the 16th century and in the 17th, led in part to the 30 Years' War, which devastated Germany between 1618 and 1648, and is estimated to have killed one third of the population.
If I may, another thing that, of course, is a lot about superstition and, you know, the answer to comments now, but another thing, I made an episode about this on Halloween, about witches that would kind of start fade away in the Enlightenment, and the superstition that witches were a thing, of course, started in the elite that kind of stopped believing in witches, and of course, as Norman did, it went further down. So let's talk about the end of witchcraft and how, as well, people would kind of start to ridicule the idea that witches was a real thing.
That's a very good and important question, partly because it's difficult to explain the disappearance of witchcraft beliefs. We have to distinguish two beliefs. One is that individuals have magical powers they use to do harm to their neighbours. The other belief is that witches get together in a kind of conspiracy and join together to worship Satan. The belief in malevolent individuals was prevalent in England. In Scotland and on the continent, you have the belief in conspiracies of witches, and there are repeated persecutions in which one person is arrested, tortured, under torture incriminates his neighbours, they in turn are tortured, etc. And therefore, the myth grows up of a vast plot or conspiracy of evildoers. King James the sixth, for example, and the first sixth of Scotland, first of England, was a great demonologist, and he thought that a storm that blew up when he was travelling with his bride back from Denmark to Edinburgh had been stirred up by witches. And the witchcraft craze was a kind of unholy alliance between popular superstition and the fantasies of intellectuals. Demonologists wrote learned books exploring the wiles of Satan and his followers, basing them on the confessions extracted under torture from people accused of witchcraft. The accused may have believed that they had magical powers, but the witch craze was the invention of, dare I say it, out of touch intellectuals. Why did this come to an end? I think the ending of belief in witches had a lot to do with the disruptions caused by 17th century wars. The civil wars in England, for example, in the 1640s. Witchcraft beliefs came to seem too fantastic to people who had many more urgent preoccupations. At all events, in the early 17th century, the truth of witchcraft seemed obvious common sense. In the later 17th century, it seemed obvious common sense that witchcraft didn't happen. One can't give the Enlightenment credit for destroying belief in witchcraft. Rather, the declined belief in witchcraft was one of the starting points for the Enlightenment. So there is still an element of uncertainty as to how the witch craze came to an end.
I remember you writing about a court case where I think she was found guilty, but I'm not entirely sure, but the judge himself is kind of, I don't think this is really a thing, but, you know, it's...
I know what you're
saying. I think the judge is kind of mocking the idea of witchcraft himself at some point.
Not the judge. I think I know the case you're thinking of.
Yeah.
We have the diary of a person who was present in court. Found it impossible to believe that these poor old women were capable of the horrendous crimes of which they were accused. And that suggests to me that alongside popular superstition, you have a great deal of popular scepticism. And I think in some ways, the Enlightenment built on a sound residue of skepticism and, if you will, good sense among ordinary people.
And of course, and another thing that we have to talk about, of course, it would be criminal if you don't mention these guys. That is, of course, the great philosophical thinkers of the Enlightenment that made the Enlightenment happen. And of course, I'm talking about the Rousseau, Diderot, and of course Voltaire. It would be criminal. You mentioned Voltaire a little bit, but it would be criminal not to talk about their contribution to the Enlightenment. How did they become like this? What was it about that suddenly enlightened them into being this legend and giants of the Enlightenment? Because nobody, everyone, even if you don't know anything about the Enlightenment or history, knows about Voltaire, and you know about Diderot, Rousseau, of course, and everyone, I think, even the most enlightened history buff, and history unless you don't know anything about history, most likely heard of these names. So, but they really are giants of the field. So let's talk about the Enlightenment thinkers and their contribution to the Enlightenment.
Okay, well, that will take us into part two, but let's make a start now. You have to think of different circumstances in different countries. There is a question whether England had an enlightenment. I think the answer is that there was a great deal of enlightened thinking, but there wasn't a self-conscious party of enlightened thinkers the way there was in Scotland and the way there was in France. In France, the Catholic Church retained an authority far greater than that held by the Church of England in this country. People who offended against its authority were liable to to imprisonment. Both Voltaire and Diderot served time in the Bastille. You mentioned Rousseau. Some of his books were confiscated and burnt by the magistrate, and he was obliged to flee to Switzerland to avoid imprisonment. So in France, there was a great deal to resist, and that favored the growth of a militant party of Lumière, of the Enlightened. They organized themselves around individuals like the philosopher D'Holbach, who held social occasions for his friends like Diderot, who seemed to be in great fun. But they also organized themselves around the project of the Encyclopédie, an encyclopedia of all available knowledge, in particular, knowledge about arts, crafts, trades, and mechanical processes. This encyclopedia can be seen in many volumes, including seven volumes given over to illustrations of technical processes. It was edited by Diderot with a number of collaborators, including Voltaire, Rousseau, Condorcet and others. And it was looked on with great suspicion by the authorities. Eventually, it was banned and had to continue in clandestine form. It did exist. It could be published in Switzerland and in the Netherlands. The Netherlands were the great refuge for enlightened thinkers banished from France, especially. And it was one of the most important books of the 18th century.
It was kind of revolutionary of his time.
Yes.
It's unique of his time. The encyclopedia wasn't it? Because no one has ever done anything like this book before, have they?
That's right. There were in the 18th century a number of encyclopedias founded with a strong desire to make knowledge easily available to a wide public, but not on the scale of the Encyclopédie and not involving crafts and technical processes so much. Legend has it that Diderot went to workshops and learned to use tools of various kinds in order to write and supervise articles in the Encyclopédie. That's a bit exaggerated, but he did visit some workshops and got a great deal of information, not from educated people, but from actual artisans. So in a way, the Encyclopédie was a somewhat democratic project. And it also redefined knowledge. It gave credit to practical knowledge, the kind of thing you didn't learn at universities. And so it was an important shift in the concept of education.
And I want to end this. We are going back to, of course, Rousseau, Voltaire, and Diderot in the next episode as well, of course, because we aren't entirely done with them. And of course, we are going to talk about Rousseau's family life, about other things in the next episode, which I'm looking forward to. But I want to end this episode with, you mentioned the scientific revolution, and I want to talk a little bit about more about the scientific revolution, and especially I want to talk about women in, as you do, in the scientific revolution and their contribution in the Enlightenment and to the scientific revolution as well.
A fair question. I'm afraid that the education of women took a step backwards rather than forwards in the Enlightenment. Those women who received an advanced education were those with the good fortune to have academic fathers who were proud of the daughter's abilities and wanted to encourage them. But they are not numerous. One who comes to mind is Dorothea von Erxleben, the first woman to qualify in medicine and practice as a doctor in Germany. That was due to the influence of her father, a doctor. Another is Laura Bassi, a female mathematician who became professor at Bologna thanks to the support and sympathy of Benedict XIV, the enlightened pope. And a third, a very important one, was Emilie du Châtelet. She was, for a long time, the girlfriend of Voltaire. They studied mathematics together. She translated Newton's Principia into French, and Voltaire wrote an introduction to the Principia. But these women were unusual exceptions, and the reasons which we can perhaps touch on in the next episode. The later Enlightenment came to think that women's minds were very much shaped by their bodies, and the women were over emotional, hysterical, unfit for intellectual pursuits. If you read the essay by Diderot sur les femmes on women, you'll find a very startling claim that women are not up to scientific pursuits because they're too much controlled by their wounds, which dispose them towards hysteria. So we can't give the Enlightenment a clean bill of health as regards feminism.
If I may, we spoke a while ago on how I made an episode of women in sexual sexuality and women in the medieval era, and we spoke about the dissolution of monasteries a while ago. But to do a comparison, in medieval times you had monasteries and nunneries that could educate women as well. And of course you have Hildebrand of Bremen. I don't remember where she from as an example of an educated woman. So was there more educated women in the medieval era, say, when nunneries had the potential to, of course, in the Enlightenment monasteries, as part of Joseph II, for example, dissolution in the monasteries in the Habsburg lands, but was the nunneries an example of how that could educate, that gave more a chance for education to women than, let's say, in the Enlightenment era?
Well, it's a fair question. I think one is tempted to idealize convents as places where women could get an education, but certainly they gave women an important social role. And there was some loss when monasteries and convents were disbanded. On the other hand, one of the recurring themes of Enlightenment writers, especially in France and other Catholic countries, is that convents are a kind of prison for women. Women are denied freedom. They're sometimes used as a dump to put delinquent women from the upper classes. So the surviving nunneries in Enlightenment get a very poor press, and I think I'd be a bit cautious about saying that nunneries and convents were a great source of education or liberation for women. Now, it was the admission of women to universities in the late 19th century that made all the difference, and one can well feel frustrated in thinking of the many, many intelligent women whose life chances were blocked by the disapproval that grew up, especially in the later 18th century, against the figure of the quote learned lady or the blue stocking, who was thought to be hopelessly unfeminine. Nevertheless, there were a number of female writers who we still read and who had an impact, and we can perhaps talk about some of them next week, in the next session.
And I think we're gonna round it up there. It's a perfect time to run up, I think. And of course, before you go, and we'll be back next week with the part two. And we only, even in those topics we discussed now, we only discussed tip of the iceberg. And that, of course, that can be, if you want to read more, you should absolutely read his book, The Enlightenment, The Pursuit of Happiness. And 1600 to 1790. And of course, as I always ask, where can people buy your book if they are interested in reading more, or where can people find you if they have further questions about the Enlightenment that we didn't perhaps have time to discuss this week? Or of course, if you have anything else you wish to share, or links in the description that you want me to share in the episode.
I think I've said my piece for today. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. I will see you next time. This has been Not That Aged Well. We are available on social media, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you're on Spotify, give us 5 stars if you like this episode. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please consider writing a review. I will try to find it and read it on this podcast. And of course, if you're on YouTube, like, share, and subscribe. My name's Alan. We'll be back for part two next week. I'll see you next time.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.